Good afternoon, and welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer, the middle 3 days of the work week. I've been thinking maybe Jim needs a nickname to match the Boy Wonder. Mature Maverick just doesn't cut it, but that's all I've come up with so far. Jim is perfected by time. I am Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim Fetzer today, tomorrow, and Thursday. I heard that Jim Fetzer got an invitation to speak this week at Yale University, home of the secret society we've all come to embrace, Skull and Bones, and feeder of talent to investment bankers, Wall Street, the CIA. Maybe Jim is going to remake Yale University with his visit this week, or at least come back with some new information about the powers that be and their plans for our futures. Well, yesterday was President's Day, and some of you enjoyed a day off, but probably didn't think too much about the presidents. And I hereby unofficially decree this is President's Week. Abraham Lincoln's birthday was exactly 1 week ago on February 12th. George Washington's birthday is coming up this Friday. And I have invited three great guests for these middle 3 days of the week to discuss the presidents, if not honor them. We've had the great, the not-so-great, the abysmal, the out-and-out traitors. And today, my guest is Alan Stang, who I will introduce shortly. Tomorrow we've got the professor of economics, Thomas DiLorenzo, who is a Lincoln scholar, among other claims to fame. And Thursday, author Jim Mars. And since this is a presidential election year, why not discuss the current crop of wonderful candidates and the marvelous things they will do to the American people, or whoever the winner is decided to be. And I couldn't help but think about H.L. Mencken, the sage of Baltimore, who said, "Democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard." And one more from H.L. Mencken, the sage of Baltimore, who said, "Every decent man is ashamed of the government he lives under." And I ask you, Alan, was that ever truer than today?
Mencken was a prophet who could look into the future, Morgan, and could see that it was what he was saying was even more true by a factor of a thousand thousands than it was when he was writing it.
Yeah, he probably didn't have that good a crystal ball, but couldn't foresee how right he was.
Well, I mean, when he was writing, Morgan, when he was writing, remember, you're talking about presidents like Coolidge.
Right, Harding.
giant presidents.
Right. Yeah, we'll get to that where really the ranking of American presidents' greatness is inverted by the historians, the camp followers of the winning army. Alan, just to give you in Radio Land a brief biography, and let's have Alan fill this out, modestly proclaims himself the American media's Sir William Wallace of Braveheart fame. That's the only way most of us know him. You're probably better looking than Mel Gibson, right? And for 50 years, Alan has been the author of, he's got about 15 books and hundreds of magazine articles. And here's a bringing in a ringer. He was one of Mike Wallace's original writers of 60 Minutes fame. And one of his books has the title, this gets at Alan's, bluntness, his everyday insight. It's not every day. It's extraordinary. Scumbags I Have Known is one of his book titles, and he is a former radio talk show host who had almost twice as many listeners as Larry King in Los Angeles. So fill that out a little for us, Alan, about your background.
Well, you gave the basic facts there, Morgan. Yes, I started out as one of Mike Wallace's original writers. I wrote a show at NBC in New York. I wrote the Mike Wallace interview. I worked at various radio stations in New York. I've written, I think it's 16 or 17 books. and as you say, a few hundred feature magazine pieces. I've lectured around the world in every state, in a few other countries, and I've been a talk show host. I've done several gigs on different networks. Right now, I'm in between gigs, talk show gigs. But that could change, of course, at any time.
Now, it's a pretty high turnover industry.
It's a very volatile industry, yes. You're on, you're off, you're on, you're off. Right now I'm off, but I do a lot of talk shows like this one.
You know, people ought to go to your website, alanstang.com, and there's some great stuff there, as well as a place to find some of your books and order same. And let's start this off with an article that brought me to know your work a bit, and it's so nice. I put it up on my website, nomoregames.net, and then did a subsequent article based on your work, and that is, What happened with Pearl Harbor? Was that a surprise attack? Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I've got an article here. Let's see, what is this title? Rating Presidential Performance by two economist friends of mine. Rating Presidential Performance. And in the conventional rankings, it is number one, Abraham Lincoln. This is by American historians and political scientists. They've got the results of three of these surveys of scholars. Abraham Lincoln won, George Washington two in one of them, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt is two in the other two surveys, and then Washington. So we have Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Washington by the conventional scholarly wisdom are the three greatest presidents. Now, as an economist that I am, of course, Roosevelt was a disaster for the domestic economy. But the Pearl Harbor attack puts his foreign policy front and center. What happened at the original Pearl Harbor? We will get to 9/11 later.
At the original Pearl Harbor, Morgan, Franklin Delano Roosevelt deliberately arranged through a process that took a couple of years, using his alliance with the English, with Churchill, deliberately arranged for the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. He wanted the Japanese to attack. He set out to provoke them to attack. He knew that they would attack, when they would attack, and he deliberately left our forces there undefended so that the results of it, the casualties, would be as great, as horrendous as they eventually turned out to be, because he needed some excuse to trick us into the war then raging in Europe, World War II. And he knew, because peace sentiment was so powerful in our country at the time, he knew that only a horrendous incident would be sufficient to turn the people around and persuade them to enter the war, and that was why he did Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, with the American experience during the so-called Great War, we weren't interested in meddling. That was the public opinion massively against. Well, we'll be back on the other side of the break with more enlightening conversation from Alan Stang. And yesterday was President's Day, and I have unofficially decreed this to be the President's Week, especially since George Washington's birthday is coming up Friday, and we are in a presidential election year, and I am speaking with Alan Stang, a wonderful writer, and one of his heroes, maybe his principal hero, is William Wallace. And I like what the Scottish rebel will call him. I like what Wallace, who was popularized in the movie Braveheart, starring Mel Gibson, what Wallace said in London prior to his execution. He was accused of being a traitor, among other things. And he said, I could not be a traitor to Edward, for I was never his subject. That's a pretty good way to put it.
Pretty good way to put it, yes. Quite dramatic. And
Alan also worked for Mike Wallace. And Mike Wallace, I recall one of the episodes he had on 60 Minutes, he was always a performer, and he usually did some interesting reports. And one of them I showed on a number of occasions in labor economics class. It was pretty daring for mainstream media because it focused on labor union violence. And I can't remember the particulars of it, but do you recall that episode he did for 60 Minutes?
I don't recall that one, Morgan, no.
But it was very, you know, how you have to keep treat the left and socialists with kid gloves, and it was very hard-hitting and truthful.
You know, I wanted to get back, if it's okay with you, to Pearl Harbor.
Sure.
I wanted to make a point I didn't have time to get in before the last break, Morgan, and that is, in the beginning, and by the beginning I mean right after Pearl Harbor, right after the war, remember there were many hearings,
mm-hmm.
and the Roosevelt, of course, the purpose of a federal hearing is to conceal the subject that is being investigated. We know that.
Well put.
And of course, that was what happened, but at the time, the Roosevelt supporters did everything they could to deny that Roosevelt had anything to do with Pearl Harbor, that he didn't provoke it, he didn't cause it, he didn't know about it. He was totally blameless.
Mm-hmm.
But by now, the interesting thing now, Morgan, I know you'll be fascinated in this as a historian as well as an economist, is that by now so much of the truth about Pearl Harbor has oozed out that now his supporters, his defenders, admit that he did it, but they've done a complete 180. Now they tell us, yes, he did it, but the reason he did it is we, the American people, you and I, Morgan, we were too stupid to know that we needed to be in the war, and so they had
mm-hmm.
he had to trick us into the war for our own good because you and I were just too dumb to know that we needed to be in it. And if you take a look, for example, at a source a book by Robert Stinnett. Robert Stinnett is a longtime professional journalist. His book is called Day of Deceit. Now, don't let that title, friends, fool you if you're not familiar with it. The title is Day of Deceit, but Stinnett is a Roosevelt supporter, and he excuses,
right.
In my article, I make this quite clear. If you don't want to read the book, simply go to my site, alanstang.com, and read the piece for yourself. And there you'll see Stinnett does just what I say. He says, well, yes, Roosevelt did this, but he had to do it. You and I and your host, Morgan Reynolds, Alan Stang, the rest, we were too stupid to know that we needed to get into the war. So Roosevelt, so much smarter than we are, tricked us into it. And so that is what the lawyers call an admission against interest. It's much better evidence than it would be coming from me, for example. So
mm-hmm.
it underlines the fact that, yes, Roosevelt deliberately put us into the war, and that's why I refer to him, among other things, not just as a swindler, talking about your subject, Morgan, economics, not just a swindler, a fraudster, but he was also a mass murderer because he deliberately arranged for the 3,000 some odd American personnel to be killed, which would to completely turn around our psychology and allow him to put us into the war.
I know that, was it 1999, one or both houses of the Congress passed resolutions to restore the reputations of Walter Short, the U.S. Army chief there in the Pacific at Pearl, and the admiral's name escapes me right at the moment.
Husband E. Kimmel.
Yes, Kimmel.
Admiral Kimmel, yes.
Yes, and they were scapegoated, of course.
Yes.
But as I recall, and now Clinton would have been the president, but he refused to sign this. So it was something they pulled up Short, either one or one of the other houses only passed it and the other one wouldn't, but their reputations really have not been restored yet.
Not completely.
Officially.
But as you said quite rightly, Morgan, they kept Admiral Kimmel and General Short, our Navy and Army commanders there at Pearl, completely in the dark about what was happening, deceived them deliberately.
Oh, yes. Although they were smart enough to get the modern warships out of Pearl.
Well, yes.
So that some of the slower World War II battleships, et cetera, suffered that was the bulk of the property damage, so to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was spectacular enough so that it turned the people around. Remember, the attitude at the time, in World War One, we had been tricked into World War One. By the time World War II comes around, now the people know that Woodrow Wilson lied, tricked us into the war. We should never have been in the war. And so here we've got now World War II going on in Europe, and we've got a tremendous peace movement run by some of the best-known figures on the American scene at the time, headed by a true American hero, aviator Charles Lindbergh. He's one of the top leaders of the peace movement. To overcome that, Roosevelt realized, in fact, Stinnett admits that maybe 85-90% of the people were adamantly opposed to entering the war. Well,
yes, 80% plus.
Yes.
As you say, we need to go back in time, but we also need to go forward in time because we have the Project for the New American Century, which advocated a catalyzing event like the Pearl Harbor, a new Pearl Harbor. And then we need to go back to Woodrow Wilson. Oh, this history is just so continuous. And we will return on the other side of the break with more talk from Alan Stang. Well, Alan, we were talking about Pearl Harbor, going back to Woodrow Wilson. Now, everybody is pretty much agreed now that Franklin Roosevelt was involved and knew and basically arranged Pearl Harbor, which puts him up as a clear traitor to the Constitution, law, and everything that's sacred about the American way. And, however, it's rationalized based on his public relations problem, and that is the American people wanted nothing to do with war in Europe. They'd been there, done that in 1917 and 1918. Now, that brings us back then to Woodrow Wilson. Now, Woodrow Wilson is a president who turns out to be ranked number six. He's in the top half dozen of the conventional presidential scholarly ratings by presidential scholars, political scientists, American historians. Number six, really the only one I truly admire in the conventional top six is Thomas Jefferson. But let's go to Woodrow Wilson. Now, Woodrow Wilson, you want to talk about the New World Order, the one world government. Here's a guy who claimed we were involved in this war, the Great War, to make the world safe for democracy, to put up a League of Nations, which was a predecessor to what they really want, which is some kind of one world government where the powers that be can exert more control. Isn't that true?
It's perfectly true, Morgan, and let me preface a few comments about Woodrow Wilson with a generic comment that I think would be of some value. You remember that President Truman would always harangue the people about the defects of the 80th Congress. He would call them the do-nothing Congress, and we've got the do-nothing presidents, the left-wingers, liberaloids, they're constantly talking about do-nothing.
We should be so lucky, right?
Yeah, do-nothing presidents, and they speak of do-nothing presidents with contempt. Actually, the good presidents, the better presidents we have are do-nothing presidents because in our system we're supposed to have do-nothing presidents and do-something people. The people are supposed to do the things, not the presidents.
Great way to put it.
So the president is supposed to be a guy in our system who sits around in the White House playing pinochle, and if something goes wrong, somebody threatens the country, then he picks up the phone and he tells the generals, make a big hole where this guy is. And basically, that's all where the president's supposed to do. You and I are supposed to do the some things, but typically the totalitarians, the collectivists, the socialists, the left-wingers, they've got it backwards, and they talk with contempt of a do-nothing president. They want the president to do the stuff in our country, and that's why we have so many of these problems. Now, Wilson is a classic example of what you're talking about there, because with Wilson, you've got a man who was chosen by the kingmakers. He was chosen by a man named Edward M. House.
Mm-hmm.
House was a Marxist. We know he was a Marxist because he wrote a book called Philip Drew, Administrator, A Story of Tomorrow. And in the book he wrote that he was working for socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx. That's what he said. And he chose Wilson to run as president because he thought that Wilson could be a front man who would serve the purpose of introducing socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx. And sure enough, under Wilson, we got the second plank of the Communist Manifesto, the graduated income tax. We got the fourth plank of the Communist Manifesto. Is it the fourth? Or the, I can't recall. Or the third, the Federal Reserve, government control.
Yeah, I don't remember the number, but yes, they called
the money.
It.
So
yes.
you've got Woodrow Wilson installing several of the key planks of the Communist Manifesto, of course under other names, all behind the machinations of this very elegant, well-spoken president of Princeton
mm-hmm.
University, manipulated.
Yeah, sophisticated professor, right.
Yes, I beg your pardon, Morgan. No offense intended, but he was a professor.
Right, yeah, we can hold that against him.
President of Princeton University, Ivy League University. And so this is what Wilson did to us. And, of course, he then, still under the tutelage of House, then launched on a campaign to trick us into World War One. Europe. And while he was, it's so interesting, the parallels, Morgan, because while Wilson was conspiring to trick us into the war, he's campaigning on a peace program. He's campaigning in 1916 for re-election using the slogan, "He kept us out of war," because he knew that's what the people wanted. The people, the American people are very pacific. We want to mind our own business. That's what Washington told us to do. That's what we want to do. So he knew the people didn't want to get into this European war. Washington had warned us about it. And so he campaigns, he kept us out of war, and at the very same time, he's conspiring with the First Lord of the Admiralty in England, a fellow named Winston Churchill,
mm-hmm.
to get us into the war. They then, between them, arrange the sinking of the Lusitania, a major war crime. It was a warship. And
in disguise.
In disguise. The German government saw what was happening and tried to advertise in American newspapers to warn the people, hey, this is a British warship, but it's an HMS, His Majesty's ship. It's a warship. It's loaded with munitions. It's not a liner. Please do not sail on this vessel. The powers that be in the United States were able to suppress, cancel all of those German government newspaper ads except one. I think somehow one of those ads in a small paper in Wisconsin actually got printed, but it wasn't enough to do the job. And so you've got hundreds of people sailing on this liner. They don't know it's loaded to the gunwales with munitions. And, of course, when the Lusitania gets close to Portsmouth, to England, First Lord of the Admiralty Churchill withdraws the destroyer screen, the protective screen, to make it easier for the U-boats to sink it. And, of course, they did. The Germans had every right under international law, under military law, to sink the vessel, which they did. You've got hundreds of people dying, and this is the big excuse now, in the big emergency. We have to go to war because they sank the Lusitania. So,
a couple things I want to intervene here and keep that thought to amplify on this, because Here is, you mentioned he kept us out of war as a Woodrow Wilson campaign slogan. Here is FDR in Boston, October 1940, running for re-election. He says, "And while I am talking to you mothers and fathers, and I've got a wonderful guest. He's quite a writer. He is fascinating. He's nails things so well. Alan Stang, and you can visit his writings at alanstang.com. And Alan, we were that break crept up on us and broke off the thought, interrupted these two
yes.
marvelous ideas I'm going to give you.
Yes.
And first one is that FDR emulating Woodrow Wilson, liar about I'm going to keep the peace. FDR said on the stump in Boston in October 1940, and this was just one of many examples, he said, "And while I'm talking to you mothers and fathers, I give you one more assurance. I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." It just makes my blood boil.
Parallels are incredible. Remember, in World War One, you've got Wilson, again, I said this, just repeat, Wilson conspiring with the First Lord of the Admiralty, Churchill. At that time, Roosevelt is Assistant Secretary of the Navy. So he's a,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and he kept that position for years. So Roosevelt was a genuine expert on the Navy. You couldn't say, well, he didn't know what he was doing. I mean, he knew all about the Navy. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy for many years. Now you move to World War II. And
Let's go back. Hold that thought. I want to go back to 1913 and enter
yes.
my second thought regarding Wilson.
Yes.
Well, you pointed out that 1913 was a disastrous year on three counts. One was the creation of the Federal Reserve and the funny money system we have. Number two was the income tax, both personal and corporate. So that this that those two things alone allow the federal government, central government, to get as big as it wants to be, to put it that way. But
yes.
here's the third kind of secret disastrous thing that happened was they approved direct elections of United States senators. The reason that's important is that senators prior to that were basically delegates from the state legislature. And that made the states more important, way more important than they are now, where they're not very important. They're basically, we have a unitary state. So a direct election means that the fixers can pretty much fix most anything the way they want it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. That's
but
why.
Go back to your, yes, you were on, back on FDR, I believe.
Well, I was just referring to the fascinating historical parallels that, as you pointed out, Morgan, now in World War II, you've got Roosevelt saying exactly the same thing Wilson did in speech after speech. Another one of my favorites, remember this one, Morgan? He said, "Eleanor hates war. I hate war. Fella hates war." Fella was his dog, the little Scotty, the Scotty dog. And so everyone in the White House hates war. Eleanor... I hate war, and Fala hates war. My dog even hates war.
What a racket. What a racket,
yes.
You know.
Yeah, all the time, he's conspiring now with Churchill, who is now, from First Lord of the Admiralty, promoted to Prime Minister, but it's the same man who connived with Wilson to get us into World War One. He is now conspiring with Roosevelt, former Assistant Secretary of the Navy, to get us into World War Two.
Now, here's the other thought that's triggered by this. It was disastrous for the U.S. to come in and throw its heavy military weight on behalf of England and France, and because otherwise they would have just ended with exhaustion. And this way, you had victors. And the invictors imposed these penalties on Germany. Remember, basically, England wanted to keep the Germans back, right? The Germans were going to be the dominant nation on the continent, and England wanted none of that.
Yes.
So this set the stage for the rise of Hitler, And so the whole thing, World War II grows almost generically out of World War
One. It's the same war. World War II. As you said quite rightly, Morgan, this is what people do not understand. The history doesn't explain this. World War One caused Hitler. There would have been, could have been no Hitler without World War One. As you said, the Germans agreed to the armistice because the Allies promised no punitive peace, no punitive peace. Now they come to the Versailles Peace Conference in Paris, and the Allies lie. They do a complete 180, and they impose a punitive peace to bring Germany to its knees. And because it's on its knees, now we have the ruinous inflation and the problems arising in Germany that paved the way for the Hitler dictatorship.
You had all these grievances that a Hitler could feed on, like the reparations, the stripping Germany, Imperial Germany of the colonies, chipping away at the size of the nation state. And basically, now this is going to be easily misinterpreted because I am no advocate of Adolf Hitler by any means, but prior to World War II, some of his statements actually made sense about rolling back the punitive measures that the Allies had imposed on Germany.
Well, of course, every dictator makes some sense. Otherwise, he couldn't impose his totalitarian rule.
Right.
So Hitler said some things that the people thought made sense. Hitler loved boat rides. He wanted to send the people on vacations, on boat rides. and our friends, the liberaloids, would certainly appreciate the fact that Hitler was a fanatic anti-smoking, anti-tobacco guy. He banned smoking in Germany.
Pro-environment.
Yes, he was a vegetarian. He was an environmentalist. He loved the outdoors and the environment. So Hitler was, of course, he was a far left-winger. Hitler was extreme left-winger. He was a National Socialist. That was the name of his party, the Nazi Party, the National Socialist Party. And he said that National Socialism is Marxism. I mean, this is what the man said.
Well, to paraphrase George Wallace, there's not a dime's worth of difference between right-wing and left-wing socialism.
Exactly. Socialism is socialism. And so all of these things grew out of World War One. Just as the day follows the night and vice versa, we would have had none of those things. And, of course, the horrors of today now grow out of the ramifications of World War II. So you've got this history proceeding, leading to one disaster after another, leading to the communist takeover of so many countries, which, of course, is not over, which still continues surreptitiously under another name. All of that started a little more than 100 years ago.
What is so lamentable to me is that once we had the collapse of the Soviet Union, and we lost our big bogeyman enemy that drove the military-industrial intelligence complex. We had an opportunity there. In fact, I looked at the defense nominal or money defense expenditures, and they were actually lower at the end of the century than they'd been 8, 9, 10 years. So basically, they were kind of dying on the vine, and we didn't have a worthy adversary anymore or anything to unify and scare the American people until they ginned up 9/11. And then things have taken off, 15-20% annual rates of growth in the MIC, the military-industrial complex. I'm hearing the Beatles ushering us off stage again. This time I'm going to be alert to it, and we will be back after the break with more talk with Alan Stang. Today you have guest host Morgan Reynolds, and I am interviewing Alan Stang of alanstang.com. And he is a marvelous writer and somebody who knows history. Alan, Henry Ford, the famous industrialist, said, it's quoted, history is bunk. Now, in one sense, that's true. If we put in the adjective conventional history, that is bunk. And one of the problems, I think, here is that Americans have been spoon-fed the rubbish, basically, from the government schools and the history establishment. And getting history right, understanding history, is very important. It's not irrelevant to today's world by any means. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, completely. Completely, Morgan. In fact, the totalitarians deliberately took control of education in our country. They deliberately organized the system of government schools so that they could complete the propagandizing, so that they could impose their version of history.
So here you're talking late 19th century America, aren't you?
Yes.
Going back then.
Well,
yes.
Yes. And a classic example of what I'm talking about is the worst president. I think we need to say something about the worst president we've ever had. Roosevelt, it is true, was a liar, a swindler, a crook. He was a traitor. He was a mass murderer.
Mm-hmm.
But despite all of that, he was not the worst president. In my opinion, I believe the worst president we've ever had was Lincoln. And the reason
yes.
I believe that specifically, Morgan, is that Lincoln destroyed our system. He destroyed the system that the Founding Fathers gave us. It had already been destroyed when Roosevelt took over, so I'm not trying to minimize Roosevelt's crimes. He was everything he said, but he didn't destroy the system. It was Lincoln who did that with his war. I call it the Lincoln's Communist War to destroy the Union. That war and the aftermath destroyed the federal system. It destroyed the Union.
It destroyed the constitutional federal republic, yes.
Exactly, so that we no longer had a union.
Let me anticipate, because my argument is that it was commonly understood that the states created the central government, dangerous institution though it was, but it was always understood that a state or set of states could secede or withdraw, and
yes.
That's the ultimate check on tyranny.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting you bring up the question of secession, Morgan, because you notice everybody on earth can secede and be applauded for it. The latest secession we've had is Kosovo. Kosovo secedes from Serbia after the horror initiated there by Bill the Rapist Clinton. With the 76 days of bombing, remember. And now, as a result of all of that, the U.S. insertion there, Kosovo secedes. El Presidente Jorge W. Bush instantly recognizes the Kosovo secession. We've had other secessions from other countries around the world over the years. Everybody can secede. The only people not allowed to secede are Americans. The United
mm-hmm.
States. We are not allowed to secede. So, in fact, it was so bad. You mentioned that the states created the Constitution. You probably know, Morgan, and I'm sure that tomorrow Tom DiLorenzo will get into this. Lincoln actually maintained that the federal government created the states. Yes, he actually said, people hear that and they scratch their heads, well, how can that be? Well, it can't be, but that's what Lincoln was saying. He was saying that you can't secede because it was the federal government that created the states.
Right. It's maddening. The history is so upside down. To go back to these polls of the intellectuals, the American historians and political scientists, it's across all polls that Lincoln was the greatest president. And you have a wonderful article, because Lincoln is intermingled with the Republican Party. And what is so maddening about the Republican Party is that the Republicans often, the office runners, the office holders often have something good to say on behalf of free enterprise and business and light taxes and limited government and being fiscally frugal, which is magic music to many of our ears, and yet they do almost the opposite. They are the biggest disappointment, I think, in American politics. The party, the Republicans, are just junk and worthless by and large. So what you claim is, don't be surprised if you go back and look at the history of the Republicans.
Exactly. And the piece that I did that you're referring to, Morgan, I entitled Republican Party Red from the Start. What we're seeing today, Morgan, is not an aberration. The big government totalitarianism like Bush's and so on, this is not an aberration. This is the heart and soul of the Republican Party. The Republican Party was formed to be a communist party. And this is from the very beginning. It was infiltrated by the communists. It was top to bottom overrun with communists. You have to remember, Morgan,
literally, that's shocking.
Literally. Remember, in 1848, you had the revolution in Europe, the revolution of 1848. That revolution, of course, was fomented by a group of very powerful, influential men in the different capitals, European capitals. Communism, of course, always is a movement by the very rich, wealthy, powerful.
The powers that be, power
exactly.
Communism.
Exactly, forcing it down on the heads, necks of the workers, of the businessmen. And so they hired this parasitical, degenerate hack writer, unknown writer, a guy named Karl Marx, to write a manifesto that would explain to the communists what they were doing. And Marx wrote it. He was so unimportant that for years, in the initial editions of the manifesto, his name did not even appear on the cover. The cover just said Manifesto of the Communist Party in German, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so they conducted the revolution. It was unsuccessful. The revolutionary leaders across Europe had to escape one or two steps ahead of the police, and those communist leaders came to the United States.
These were by the hundreds?
Yes. They came to the United States, and they infiltrated our system in the North. They entered the Republican Party. Remember, the Republican Party was founded in 1856, just a few years later. And by the time the war started, many of these communist leaders were Union generals.
with no military experience.
Well, some of them did have military experience, Morgan. Some of them were communist military officers, and some of them, as you say, did not have any military experience, but they were communists. General Weidemeyer, for example, that would be one example. General Weidemeyer was a top Union general. He was a communist revolutionary from Europe and a friend of Marx.
We will be back with Alan Stang on the Dynamic Duo after our break. Today, you have the thrill, the pleasure of listening to Morgan Reynolds as your guest host, and today I have Alan Stang to discuss presidents, and we're going to get to the contemporary presidential run. We do have an election year, but we want to do a little more history, and we, before the break, we're discussing Abraham Lincoln and the origins of the Republican Party, the shocking origins, where Alan says basically it was communists who formed the party, and many of these communists from Europe were generals in the Union Army. I recall there's a great book by Jeffrey Hummel that I've used in American history classes, economic history, called Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men, a very good history of the American Civil War. And at the outset of this book, Hummel points out that there are over 50,000 books on the Civil War, the so-called Civil War. And it's amazing at one, superficially, that there's so much, such an outpouring of the narrative and investigation of this event. But when you think about it a little, go a little more deeply, in a way, that is well deserved. Because as you pointed out, Lincoln virtually changed everything. And he did so many evil things, like inflation, income taxes, suspending habeas corpus. But it all goes to when he came into office, it was recognized. Look, the sectional battle had been going on for a long time. And when he came into office, he was strictly a regional candidate. And right away, the seven deep South states seceded. And what should the incoming Abraham Lincoln have done? Well, fine, I hope you, fare well. It's been fun, right? But no, what did he do? He orders, one thing, without any congressional consent, he orders that every state will send a militia contingent to begin the war. Right? And that put the upper South, the mid-South, over the line, too. I live in Arkansas, for example, and Arkansas seceded in the second wave of secessions when it became clear what Lincoln was all about. Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am. And what he should have said at this point was, okay, goodbye and good luck. We'll treat you fairly, and maybe mm-hmm. later on we can get together after this disparity, after
right.
this tax unfairness is resolved. But remember, Morgan, you go back to the beginning. You have Hamilton, the advocate of a very powerful central government, the advocate of a central bank. All right, his ideas are inherited by Henry Clay of Kentucky, who called what he wanted the American system. We would call it today socialism for the rich, handouts to big companies. We would call it socialism for the rich in our country. In Italy, they did call it fascism, the corporate state.
Right, industrial subsidies and infrastructure projects and on and on.
Exactly. Then you've mm-hmm. got a very sophisticated, high-level railroad lawyer, Lincoln, who was a lawyer for these big corporate entities. His hero,
he was a lobbyist. For the
lobbyist,
big
exactly.
railroads.
Exactly.
Right.
His hero is Henry Clay. He inherits Hamilton's ideas from Henry Clay. And so he is prepared when the Whig Party unravels, now the Republican Party is formed. He is the candidate of the big corporations of the time, of the fascism, of the government handouts. These are the people that Lincoln represented, that he was making these big legal fees representing, these big
mm-hmm.
companies. Slavery was something that it was not part of what Lincoln was interested in. Lincoln was a blatant racist. He wanted to kick black people out of the country, send them back to Africa. He believed that black people were inferior. He said so quite blatantly again and again. The slavery issue was an afterthought for Lincoln. You can see that, for example, in the Emancipation Proclamation, which comes only a couple of years into the war and doesn't really free any slaves at all, doesn't free one
slave. No, he declares those states, slaves in secession states, free.
Exactly. He says that, if the southern states were really so interested in maintaining slavery, if that was what they wanted, they would have just stayed in the Union. Lincoln said, you stay in the Union and slavery will continue. I have nothing against this black slavery,
yes.
said Lincoln. So everything we've been told about Lincoln's communist war to destroy the Union is a fraud, but the bottom line is that Lincoln, with the help of these maniac, insane abolitionists from New England, with the help of the communists who had escaped from Europe and came here after the unsuccessful revolution of 1848. Lincoln put all this together and destroyed our federal republican system. And from then on, we had a different system, a centralized government in which the states were mere appendages, more and more appendages of the federal government rather than the independent sovereign.
They're administrative subunits,
exactly.
Basically, when push comes to shove. Yes.
The thing that you mentioned, Morgan, the direct election of senators, that was a final step toward the destruction of the influence of the states and the reduction of the states to mere provinces, administrative provinces. And by the way, Morgan, I'm reminding myself now, one of the appeals to Lincoln in the minds of Lincoln, in the minds of these communists who came here, was Germany, where many of them came from, not all of them, many of them came from Germany. Germany was composed of historic sovereign states. They had legislatures. They had independent people in the legislatures elected by the voters. Well, the communists there didn't like that. They wanted a huge centralized totalitarian system. And so when they saw that Lincoln was trying to prevent the departure of the southern states, and that Lincoln wanted the kind of system they wanted in Germany, naturally they were attracted to Lincoln. And that was one of his appeals,
right,
in their minds.
Right, tyrant. Yeah. They were kinfolk under the skin, no question. And here we got our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, is the worst, according to our guest, Alan Stang. So we will have more contrarian talk after the break from the Dynamic Duo. Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer, the middle 3 days of the work week. But for today, tomorrow, and Thursday, where Morgan Reynolds, that's me, will be your guest host. And today I've got Alan Stang. We're talking presidents because this is President's Week. And we need to do a little bit more on Mr. Abraham Lincoln, usually touted as the greatest president. But Alan insists he was our worst. And one of the tragic consequences of Lincoln is, and I don't think this is well known, is that if you'd allowed the Southern Deep South states to secede, in other words, Lincoln says, well, we wish you well, we'll continue to trade, we're a commercial republic. If he'd done the right thing, there wouldn't have been any war. Moreover, slavery would have quickly fallen of its own inherent instabilities and inefficiencies, because slavery, which is a property institution where one person can own other persons, would have quickly fallen, because slaves could, once you make it across the line, the Constitution and the law enforcement apparatus would no longer protect it. And we can also point to, so the logic is, slavery would have quickly fallen of its own infirmities. And nowhere else in the world that I know of, certainly not in the Americas, had ever such a costly effort been suffered to end slavery. It ended in other countries at fairly small cost. So that's another, this unearned reputation of Lincoln is completely myth.
It's completely phony. Yes, for just one prominent example, in the same year he began the communist war to destroy the Union, the Tsar in Russia freed the slaves in that country. Remember, Morgan, how did he do it? He signed a document.
Right.
That's all. He signed a document.
He didn't even need any serious government expenditures. Usually the issue was, what compensation would there be for slaveholders?
Yes, there was no compensation. He just signed a document. They were free. No war at all. So,
okay, there are a couple more subjects I wanted to get your input on, and the first is 9/11. Now, what struck me is that it grows out of our previous conversation where we discussed Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, both presidents rated in the top half dozen by conventional wisdom. And the problem arose in the year 2000 with this document put out by the Project for the New American Century. There's a famous sentence in there which says, to paraphrase, that in the absence of a catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor, our wonderful plan for global domination and abundant military expenditures is not going to come to pass. And this century included such luminaries as Jeb Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, on and on. And lo and behold, within 1 year, we had a catalyzing event called 9/11.
Yes.
So, Alan, for people of our erudition and leanings, we know that this is an inside job. And my question to you, since you have firm opinions about the powers that be and the layers that we have to penetrate here, do you think Bush, President Bush, who looked like he was completely out of it that morning at the Emma Booker Elementary School, do you think he was in on it from the beginning, or was he caught unawares, or what was going on there?
All I can do with that question, Morgan, is I can speculate, and my speculation is that he probably didn't know any details because he couldn't be trusted with details like that. It would obviously, it's an intelligence operation, which obviously would invoke the implement the need to know principle. He didn't need to know, which would give him a so-called plausible deniability. Also, he's not an intelligence guy. You couldn't trust him with the events. He's a world-class drunk. You can't trust a guy like that.
Right. Whether he's sober or not at the moment, he's a world-class drunk. Right.
Yes. And so my speculation is that he probably didn't know the details, but he has participated in the cover-up.
And if
the way I explain it to myself, Morgan, is I do not know for sure what did happen, but I do know for sure what did not happen. I do know that what happened could not possibly have been what Bush and company tell us happened. And that proves that,
right,
that something is wrong. They are trying to conceal what happens, what happened, and that proves that they are implicated.
Yeah, the official conspiracy theory is completely fallacious on almost everywhere you look. You dig down for a few facts, and it's completely false.
You simply have to ask yourself, could all of these things that we know are facts, that no one disputes are facts, could all of these things, could they all, what is the likelihood, looking at it scientifically, what is the scientific likelihood that all these things could have happened coincidentally by accident? You know, if one or two of these or three of these things happened, you would scratch your head and you would say, well, isn't this odd? Look over here, Morgan. They didn't scramble the planes. Or Morgan, look over here. You've got
no intercept any of these alleged four airliners.
Right. So you and I would be speculating as pointy heads, fellow pointy heads, back and forth. We'd say, isn't this odd, Morgan? Yes, Alan, look at it. They didn't scramble. But when you've got hundreds of these things, literally hundreds of these, then you have to scratch your head again and you say, how likely is it that all of these things could happen by accident? And you realize to say that they could happen like this would be to spit in the face of the law of probability.
Oh, yes. Right. There's no chance, and there's no blankety-blank chance.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is all we need to know to overturn the governmental apple cart. We don't have to prove what happened.
Is that
we know what didn't happen, and we are able to prove that.
Now, the importance of this event is rather similar to the original Pearl Harbor. We'll call it the inside, some of the inside participants termed it a new Pearl Harbor. And it did swing instantly American public opinion within a few years. Certainly within 5 years, defense expenditures, as one indicator, doubled. So they went from basically dying on the vine, no interest in this, with the demise of the Soviet Union, etc., to just flush the defense contractors. And then, of course, we have just an outpouring of gushing, like the creation of the Homeland Security Empire, the TSA, the Transportation Security, on and on.
Yes.
Just incredible growth of government, so welcomed by our socialist powers to be. Okay, here we hear the Beatles, and we shall be back with more. We need to talk contemporary presidential politics when we come back with Alan Stang. For this week, when Morgan Reynolds is sitting in for Jim Fetzer as your host, and during this last segment, Alan, this time just escapes so fast here. Seems like we've got 2 hours. We can do it leisurely, but we're down to the crunch here, and we need to talk about contemporary presidential politics. And to answer John Lennon, I don't want a revolution. I want a restoration of the constitutional republic. Can any of these candidates give it to us? Let's first of all spend a couple minutes on the Democrats, where we've got Hillary Rodham Clinton versus Barack Obama.
All right.
Obama, what's going on with Obama? He's a charismatic speaker.
He is a charismatic speaker, undoubtedly. Here you have a man who could be president. His name is Hussein. He was raised as a Muslim. He belongs to a virulently racist church, loyal to Farrakhan and to Africa, and not to the United States. He works with violent communists there in Africa to impose Islamic law. The communists that he's been working with there in Africa have been killing Christians, burning churches. That would be one candidate. The other candidate is a Stalinist womanoid. By the way, for those of you misogynists who are out there who are worried about the possibility of a woman president, you can relax. There is no chance that we will get a woman president. There's been a, Morgan, you may know this, there's been a rumor circulating on the Internet. I have not been able to track it down, according to which Hillaroid is a woman. And, of course, that is utterly preposterous. It is true that she does share some of the superficial characteristics.
There are two sexes, right, but
yes,
their
gender. She does share some. A womanoid does, like a real woman, will have a tendency to have a more pronounced forecastle and after deck.
Let's go back to Obama. Hillary, of course, is a powers-that-be approved, fully registered socialist. But Obama, would he end the war in Iraq or withdraw from American intervention in the Middle East
I don't believe so.
I
believe he will do just what they tell him to do, and that would be to continue the war. The only candidate, a viable candidate presently running for president who would end the war is Dr. Ron Paul, who is still in the race. I know his enemies have been trying to create the idea that he's left the race, that he's no longer running. That is not true. He is running. He's in the race. He has delegates and will be at the convention.
And the other Republican, get your comments. We'll spend more time on Ron in a minute, but get your comments on John McCain and Mike Huckabee.
Well, of course, McCain is a deranged crank. He has done everything he could to betray his fellow prisoners of war, to be nasty to the families, to prevent the POWs, the communists kept from returning home. And the reason he's done that probably is that he's afraid of what the returning POWs would say about him. He's a man whom Soviet brainwashers in Vietnam may well have turned into one of their own. Many experts on McCain, many POW military experts, tell us that he's a Manchurian candidate, that he's actually a Soviet agent. And you can speculate about the possibility of that when you see his behavior. For example, The top North Vietnamese communist torturer came to the United States, to Washington, When he entered the room, McCain leaped up, ran across the room, and embraced this man as if he were a long-lost brother. His record in the Senate places McCain on the far left end of the Democrat Party, and he says he has no qualms. He smiles, he laughs about it. He has no qualms about keeping us in Iraq for another 100 years.
Right. For what purpose? Yes. And these are really nasty pieces of work. McCain and Mike Huckabee,
Huckabee, we know, Huckabee is a fraud, a liar. His own staff admits, his own staff says, no, he does not have that theology degree that he was boasting about on stage during the debates,
mm-hmm.
remember?
That
was one of his weapons. Well, I'm the only guy up here with a theology degree. Well, now his own staff says, no, he doesn't have a theology degree. He's a far leftist. He's a socialist. He's now trying to cover that fact. He has been leading one of the leaders of the illegal alien invasion of our country, but now he is trying to copy what Dr. Paul says. He now says he wants to abolish the income tax. Preposterous.
With a 23% national sales tax?
Yeah.
It's like H.L. Mencken says, when they find a new tax, they don't remove the old ones.
No, they love taxes. They love to add and add.
Now,
and
the
add.
Republicans, really, they don't have a prayer in you-know-where, barring some kind of a 9-11 thing again, do they? I mean, I can't see either McCain or Huckabee getting elected president on the Republican ticket without some kind of extraordinary foreign policy or terror event bigger and better than 9-11.
I think you're right. I think that in desperation, it's quite possible the people will go to one of the Democrats. And right now, of course, we'll have to find out later on tonight what happened in Wisconsin and Hawaii. But right now, it looks like it's going to be Obama, Hussein Obama.
Yes, odds are he's going to be the nominee. And I think he will run a heck of a campaign, as he's done within the Democrat Party. Now, what about, there's going to be unhappiness with both of these. Obama might be able to make a semi-unifying pitch to his party to stay together and take over the whole federal government aside from the Supreme Court. But what about a third-party effort? You mentioned Ron Paul. He could perhaps get a double-digit, maybe a 10% as a third-party candidate.
So far, Dr. Paul has said that he would not run on a third-party ticket. And, of course, he's had to say that to keep his congressional race for re-election to the Congress and his race for the presidency alive. If he were to say at this point, I'll run third party, it would totally destroy those two candidacies. But, of course, I suppose that could change. And, of course, there is the Constitution Party already in operation. It ran Mr. Badnarik for president last time, so there already is a third party. It would be just a question of which candidate they would choose. So any one of these possibilities could be implemented, yes.
Ross Perot, what did he get? 19% or something?
Yes, he got 19%. But and of course, remember, his candidacy was not a genuine candidacy. He wasn't in the race to win. He was in the race to keep the presidency, to keep re-election away from the man he hated, George H.W. Bush, and he succeeded in doing that.
And I can't recall. Now, Bush argued the a lot of people have argued that Bush really, Herbert Walker Bush, ran, or was president in effect for three terms, meaning that he and Jim Baker, basically were acting as president with a partially disabled Ronald Reagan. Who suffered, of course, an assassination attempt within 60 days of his first inauguration.
Yes, and there's a lot of evidence to indicate that that could be true, Morgan.
Well, this is going to be an interesting election now. Obama, you don't offer any hope for him. He's a complete communist, if you will, and
complete tool of the
anti-war factions that are putting their stock in him are completely misled.
I believe they are.
Well, maybe we're going to have a third-party race. It's going to be fascinating. And my thanks to Alan Stang for coming on the Dynamic Duo today and giving us lots of good things to think about. Go to his website, alanstang.com.